Chapter 2. The Hidden Hand. Richard Mellon Scaife. For many years, in the foyer of Richard Mellon Scaife's Pittsburgh mansion stood a prized possession, a brass elephant on a mahogany stand. Visitors could be forgiven for mistaking it for the usual Republican mascot, because Scaife's forebears, who founded the Mellon Banking, Alcoa Aluminum, and Gulf Oil Empire, were a financial mainstay of the Republican Party in Pennsylvania for more than a century. But the elephant in question was instead an homage to Hannibal, the fabled military strategist who daringly scaled the Alps on elephant back to launch a surprise attack on the Roman Empire. It served as the inspiration for a private organization that Scaife founded in 1964. This little heralded group was just the first small step in what would become an improbably successful effort by one of the richest men in the country, along with a few other extraordinarily wealthy conservative benefactors, to cast themselves as field generals in Hannibal's mold in a strategic war of ideas aimed at sacking American politics. For decades, Scaife was described as a recluse, mysterious even to the recipients of his largesse. Over a 50-year period, he personally spent what he estimated to be upward of $1 billion from his family fortune on philanthropy, once the sum was adjusted for inflation. Most of it, some $620 million, he reckoned, was aimed at influencing American public affairs. In 1999, the Washington Post called him the leading financial supporter of the movement that reshaped American politics in the last quarter of the 20th century. When he died on July 4, 2014, the New York Times carried a lengthy obituary along with his photograph, yet he gave almost no interviews or speeches on his motives and aims. He rarely spoke with those who ran the institutions he funded, and was estranged from many former friends and family members, including two former wives and his two grown children. When Karen Rothmeyer, a reporter for the Columbia Journalism Review, tried to ambush him into an interview in 1981, he warned her, "You fucking communist cunt, get out of here." In 2009, however, 5 years before he was diagnosed with inoperable cancer, Scaife penned a previously private, still unpublished memoir, A Richly Conservative Life, that serves as a secret tell-all about the building of the modern conservative movement. In his memoir, Scaife describes how he and a handful of other influential conservatives who shared the view that American civilization faced an existential threat from progressivism began meeting during the Cold War years, at first informally, to plot against the country's liberal drift. At one such session, someone suggested that the threadbare cliché comparing America's ostensible downfall to that of ancient Rome was inadequate. The group decided that a better analogy was to the fall of Carthage in North Africa. Carthage ostensibly fell when its wealthy elites failed to adequately back their military leader, Hannibal, as he reached the gates of Rome. The passivity of the ruling class allowed the enemy to triumph, burying the noble Carthaginian culture forever. Out of this discussion was born the League to Save Carthage, an informal network of influential, die-hard American conservatives determined, as Scaife writes, that America must not go the way of Carthage, that we must win the struggles of our time. In 1964, when this group incorporated itself formally as the Carthage Foundation, many conservatives felt like the remnants of a lost civilization. Their standard-bearer, the Republican presidential nominee Barry Goldwater, had been badly defeated at the polls. The Democratic victor, Lyndon Johnson, meanwhile, was forging ahead with liberal civil rights legislation and ambitious Great Society anti-poverty programs, radically expanding the reach of government and challenging the old order. Liberal dominance over arts and letters was so uniform during these post-war years that the cultural critic Lionel Trilling had declared with self-satisfaction, "Nowadays there are no conservative or reactionary ideas in general circulation." M. Stanton Evans, a leading intellectual on the right, captured conservative sense of marginalization in his 1965 book, The Liberal Establishment: Who Runs America and How? He declared that the chief point about the liberal establishment is that it is in control. In response, right-wing activists like Evans, who had studied with Ludwig von Mises, militated for a counter-establishment, yet they lacked the wherewithal with which to build it. Stepping into this void and up to this challenge was, as the engraved brass plate beneath his elephant proclaimed, Field Marshal Richard Mellon Scaife, the Carthaginian hero of the half-century, 1950 to 2000. The plaque praised Scaife's audacity, fidelity, and persistence. Christopher Ruddy, a conservative reporter and publisher who worked closely with Scaife for many years, sharing some of his political adventures, believes that Scaife was the progenitor of a new form of hard-hitting political philanthropy. He's the originator of the current model, says Ruddy. I don't know anyone who did what he did before. He's a bit like Santa Claus. In his early years, few would have expected Scaife to exert major influence on politics or much else. Certainly he was born into extraordinary wealth. In 1957, Fortune ranked his mother, Sarah Mellon Scaife, and three other members of the Mellon family among the eight wealthiest people in America. But Scaife wasn't notably distinguished in any other way. Until his mid-30s, he had no real career or accomplishments. Even by his own estimation, his life was dissolute. In his memoir, he writes that one of his favorite authors was John O'Hara, because no one has better captured the decadence and the disappointment that were rife in his own upper-crust circle. How beautifully he summed up Pennsylvanians of a certain class, Scaife writes, their country club values, the wrecks they made of their lives on too much money and alcohol. Scaife's great-grandfather, Judge Thomas Mellon, the founder of the family fortune, had worried about the corrupting influence that inherited wealth might have on future heirs. The son of an Irish farmer who settled in Pennsylvania during the first half of the 19th century, Mellon proved an uncannily good businessman. He leveraged real estate investments into a thriving loan business that became Pittsburgh's stately Mellon Bank. During the Gilded Age, the family acquired huge stakes in a number of burgeoning industrial corporations, including Gulf Oil and Alcoa. Surveying his great fortune, however, in 1885, Mellon fretted that the normal condition of man is hard work, self-denial, acquisition, and accumulation. As soon as his descendants are freed from the necessity of exertion, they begin to degenerate sooner or later in body and mind. By the time his great-grandson Richard Mellon Scaife was born in Pittsburgh in 1932, some of the patriarch's darkest fears had been realized. Sarah Mellon Scaife, the mother of the boy who was known to his family as Dickie, by all accounts struggled to fight a losing battle with alcoholism. She was a gutter drunk, according to her daughter, the late Cordelia Scaife May. So was Dick, Cordelia said of her brother. So was I. If they were born with silver spoons, they were also born with chips on their shoulders. In his memoir, Scaife describes himself as fundamentally anti-establishment, which may seem puzzling given his heritage, but his place within the Mellon dynasty was tinged with resentment. His mother had married a handsome and well-connected local patrician, Alan Scaife, who rode well to the hounds and had attended all the most elite schools, but whose forebears had run the family metalworking company into the ground. As a result, Richard Scaife's uncle, R.K. Mellon, who, like his mother, had inherited a large part of the vast Mellon fortune, treated the Scaife family with scorn. My father, he was sucking hind tit, Scaife told Burton Hirsch, who wrote a biography of the family in 1978. In his memoir, Scaife writes that his uncle, who was his closest Mellon relative, and whom he and his sister dubbed Uncle Piggy, treated my father like an errand boy. Alan Scaife was given ceremonial titles in the various Mellon business concerns, but no real power other than to oversee his wife's enormous inheritance. Alan Scaife briefly cut a dashing figure during World War II when he enlisted in the Office of Strategic Services, OSS, the forerunner of the Central Intelligence Agency, CIA, as an Army major. But while his tailor-made uniforms made a memorable impression, this was less true of his job performance. Richard Helms, who later became director of the CIA, recalled Scaife, who had been a colleague, as a lightweight. The family brush with the spy service, however, ignited Richard Scaife's lifelong infatuation with intelligence intrigue, conspiracy theories, and international affairs. Scaife writes that it also gave rise to his strongly anti-communist views. In his memoir, he recalls his father admonishing the family while on furlough from the war that the scourge of communism loomed large, not just abroad, but at home in America. "My political conservatism, which eventually unmasked me as the villain behind the vast right-wing conspiracy of Hillary Clinton's imagination, but only her imagination," he writes, "began before I had reached my 12th birthday, over a lunch with his father at New York's Colony Club in 1944. Alan Scaife warned the family that wealthy capitalists like themselves were under attack. He invoked images of labor riots and class warfare. "He was concerned for the security of the country and gave us the feeling around the table that our entire future was at stake," Scaife writes. A local newspaper editor, William Block of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, had similar recollections. He remembered Alan Scaife as overwrought during the 1940s about what he regarded as the growing threat that leftists posed to the rich. "Alan Scaife was terribly worried about inherited wealth," he later recalled. The family's preoccupation with preserving its wealth was shared by previous generations. Scaife was heir not just to one of the country's greatest industrial fortunes, but also to a distinctly reactionary political outlook rooted in the age of the robber barons. His great uncle, the Pittsburgh banker Andrew Mellon, who served as Treasury Secretary under Presidents Warren Harding, Calvin Coolidge, and Herbert Hoover, was a leading figure in the counter-revolution against the progressive movement, and in particular, he was an implacable foe of the income tax. Before Congress instituted the federal income tax in 1913, following the passage of the 16th Amendment to the Constitution, America's tax burden fell disproportionately on the poor. High taxes were levied on widely consumed products such as alcohol and tobacco. Urban property was taxed at a higher rate than farms and estates. From top to bottom, American society before the income tax was a picture of inequality, and taxes made it worse, writes Isaac William Martin, a professor of sociology at the University of California in San Diego. In his history, Rich People's Movements, Grassroots Campaigns to Untax the 1%, Martin notes that the passage of the income tax in 1913 was regarded as calamitous by many wealthy citizens, setting off a century-long tug-of-war in which they fought repeatedly to repeal or roll back progressive forms of taxation. Over the next century, wealthy conservatives developed many sophisticated and appealing ways to wrap their anti-tax views in public-spirited rationales. As they waged this battle, they rarely mentioned self-interest, but they consistently opposed high taxes that fell most heavily on themselves. And no figure was more instrumental in leading the early opposition than Andrew Mellon. When Congress instituted the federal income tax, Mellon was one of the wealthiest men in America, with interests in dozens of monopolistic conglomerates, then called trusts. His Union Trust Bank reportedly financed almost half the investments in Pittsburgh. In his view, the economic inequality that such arrangements produced was not only inevitable, it was the just reward for excellence and virtue. In an effort to win popular support for this outlook, he wrote a mass-market book called Taxation, The People's Business, in which he argued, counterintuitively, that cutting taxes on the rich would boost tax payments, not lower them, and so was a matter of broad public interest, not narrow private gain. 60 years later, Yehuda Winiski, the father of supply-side economics, would pay homage to Mellon as his inspiration. At the time, though, Mellon's anti-tax book sold poorly, despite bulk purchases by business leaders. Once in public office, Mellon helped define the 1920s as an era during which business succeeded in rolling back many of the progressive era's reforms. In 1921, capital gains taxes were cut and the stock market boomed. After repeated efforts during his dozen-year tenure at Treasury, in 1926, Mellon finally succeeded in getting a bill passed that cut the tax rates on the richest Americans more deeply than any other tax law in history, according to Martin. Mellon promised greater growth and prosperity. When instead the stock market crashed in 1929 after a frenzy of speculation, his legacy was tarnished. Not only did his economic theories look self-serving and irresponsible, but it surfaced that Mellon himself had been secretly providing tax credits and subsidies to some of the country's biggest businesses, including many in which the Mellon family had major investments. Eventually, Mellon was charged and acquitted of income tax fraud. He was required, though, to pay back taxes, which was a humiliation and indignity for the patrician family. 3 years after the 1929 stock market crash, against this backdrop of class conflict and financial chicanery, Richard Mellon Scaife was born. His family, and later he himself, would continue to portray their embrace of low taxes and limited government as matters of high principle, as Andrew Mellon had. But his parents' elaborate estate planning in order to minimize their own tax bills suggests that they had more than an abstract interest in the subject. Scaife's parents created the largest of the family's tax-exempt charitable foundations, the Sarah Scaife Foundation, in December 1941, days after the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. It appears to have been timed to shelter the family's wealth from anticipated tax increases. Scaife writes, "I don't know what my parents' specific motives were, but he notes that because of the impending war, there was talk of a top income tax rate of above 90%. Roosevelt and the labor unions argued that the wealthy should shoulder a greater share of the cost of the war buildup to provide an equality of sacrifice." Despite their hawkish views on national defense, the family nonetheless took steps to avoid paying its share for the military buildup. As Scaife writes matter-of-factly in his memoir, "The rich inevitably are going to organize their wealth to avoid government confiscation. They'll do whatever the law allows to use their money as they see fit, out of reach of the tax collector." Meanwhile, the Scaifes lived large. They commissioned a hulking Cotswold-style stone country house on 725 acres in Ligonier, Pennsylvania, next to Rolling Rock Farms, the Mellon family's 9,000-acre ancestral estate. They called their place Penguin Court for the pet penguins that Sarah Scaife found amusing to let waddle the grounds. Rookeries were built in the shape of igloos and filled daily with slabs of ice. The weekend house was so vast that by Scaife's reckoning he had 4 rooms to himself as a boy. Rather than counting sheep, like less well-off insomniacs, he writes, "When I can't sleep, I try to recount the rooms, which numbered 50 or 60. The lavish lifestyle didn't protect Scaife, however, from suffering a terrible head injury in a riding accident at the age of 9. The fall fractured his skull, knocking him unconscious for 8 to 10 hours and requiring metal clips to be implanted in his head. As a result, he had to be tutored at home for more than a year and avoid vigorous athletics all his life. The injury also barred him from military service. But as he lay at home in his sick bed, he followed current events closely, mapping the troop movements during World War II and developing a lifelong passion for newspapers, which he read avidly as a boy and later would own. The family's insulation from workaday life also couldn't protect the Scaife children from being jeered during the Depression and war years by passers-by who catcalled at the sight of them being chauffeured by themselves in the backs of limousines as gas was rationed for others. Scaife recalls that by the time he was about 10, he realized that, compared to most people, the Scaifes were different. We were very wealthy. He says that in his youth he feared people would dislike him because of it, but he writes that, unlike most liberals, as he grew older, he came to feel entitled to his good fortune. Some of my friends, most, I'd say, feel a sense of guilt about having money. I do not, and never have. As he describes it, an inheritance comes to the person, but also to his community and country. It can do powerful good. He notes, I've felt good about being able to put dollars to work in the battle of ideas. Scaife recalled his childhood as happy. He liked the governess who raised him, admired his father, and adored his mother. But his sister Cordelia, who was 4 years older, saw their upbringing differently. She described the family as excelling principally in making each other totally miserable. The only substance that appears to have been in nearly as great supply as money in the Scaife household was alcohol. By the time he was sent off to Deerfield Academy at the age of 14, the same prep school attended 8 years later by David Koch, Scaife was already a drinker. Caught drinking off campus with some local girls in his senior year, in violation of Deerfield's rules, he almost didn't graduate. Scaife recalls that his parents hastily donated funds for a new dormitory for the school in order to assure his diploma. Years later, he would nonetheless help fund the social critic Charles Murray, a leading proponent of the theory that a superior work ethic and moral codes account for much of the success among the affluent. Despite having barely squeaked through prep school, Scaife was accepted at his father's college, Yale, from which he was soon expelled following several drunken benders. A reputation as a frat boy bully was cemented by an episode in which an empty beer keg was rolled down a flight of stairs, injuring a classmate. Scaife writes that he was falsely accused of launching the keg, which was actually jettisoned by his friends. After getting arrested off campus in another drunken escapade, he belittled the dean who was adjudicating his case, hastening his expulsion. Nonetheless, the following year, Scaife was given the chance to repeat his freshman year at Yale. But after spending time at the movies rather than in class, he soon flunked out, this time for good. Yet, with the help of his father, who was chairman of the board, he graduated from the University of Pittsburgh and soon went on to enter the family business, Gulf Oil. His behavior, however, didn't much improve. At the age of 23, after drinking and in a hurry to visit his fiancée, Frances Gilmore, on a rainy night, he caused a near-fatal car accident that left him with a shattered knee and an expensive legal settlement with the family whose car he had rear-ended. Alcoholism and freakish tragedy continued to dog his adult life. One friend committed suicide in front of him. Another, his sister's husband, died of a gunshot wound under mysterious circumstances. His brother-in-law's death was ruled an accident or suicide, but caused a scandal and a lasting rift between the siblings because Cordelia suspected that somehow her brother had been involved. In 2005, facing fatal illness, Cordelia too took her own life, asphyxiating herself with a plastic bag. She left an estate valued at $825 million. Before these later tragedies unfolded, though, in 1958, Scaife's father died suddenly. Scaife was only 26. He recalled that it was a watershed year for me. His father bequeathed him the failing family metal company, which he soon sold for a dollar, and a powerless seat on the Mellon Bank board, which his disdainful uncle chaired. More important, Scaife was put in charge of his mother's finances, giving him responsibility for investing hundreds of millions of dollars. The first priority had to be to look after mother's affairs, as dad had done, he writes. At the age of 54, Sarah Scaife was a woman of wealth, but no experience managing it. So an unavoidable role for me became simply that of investor, just taking care of it all. Soon after his father died, his mother set up two charitable trusts of $50 million each. The beneficiaries were Scaife and his sister. Like the Koch family, the Scaifes designed the trusts so that all net income had to be donated to nonprofit charities for the next 20 years. After that, the $50 million principal could pass to each of the Scaife offspring, free from inheritance taxes. In other words, two decades of philanthropy was the price for a tax-free inheritance. As Scaife wrote of the setup, "Isn't it grand how tax law gets written?" Scaife notes that his mother thought it a good deal because in 1961 she created a second pair of similar trusts for her children, this time with $25 million for each beneficiary. This time, the terms of the trust required Scaife and his sister to donate the net interest to charity over just 10 years, and in 1963, his mother set aside another $100 million more in trusts, this time for her grandchildren, called the Sarah Scaife Grandchildren's Trust. The net interest, again, had to be donated, this time over 21 years. Because Cordelia had no children, control of the entire $100 million in the grandchildren's trust reverted to Scaife, who by then had a small son and a daughter. So for the next 21 years, until 1984, he thus directed virtually all of the charitable donations stemming from the interest on all three trusts, which cumulatively held assets of $250 million. Both the assets and the amount of annual interest they spun off were remarkably large sums in those years. Scaife, in his memoir, describes the method by which his mother was able to pass on her fortune to him tax-free as a socially useful tax shelter. He writes, "It enabled a donor to set aside a lump sum for heirs free of inheritance tax or gift tax, but only after an interval of public benefit. To me, that's a good deal for both sides." A consequence, however, was that the tax code turned many extraordinarily wealthy families, intent upon preserving their fortunes, into major forces in America's civic sector. In order to shelter themselves from taxes, they were required to invent a public philanthropic role. In the instance of both the Kochs and the Scaifes, the tax law ended up spurring the funding of the modern conservative movement. Motivated in part by tax concerns, Scaife's role as a philanthropist grew. An immediate question, however, was how to disperse the constantly accumulating piles of interest from the trusts, which needed to be distributed to charity in order to satisfy the tax laws. One attractive solution for enormously wealthy families like the Scaifes and the Kochs was to donate to their own private philanthropic foundations. By doing so, they could get the tax deductions and still keep control of how the charitable funds were spent. Private foundations have very few legal restrictions. They are required to donate at least 5% of their assets every year to public charities, referred to as non-profit organizations. In exchange, the donors are granted deductions, enabling them to reduce their income taxes dramatically. This arrangement enables the wealthy to simultaneously receive generous tax subsidies and use their foundations to impact society as they please. In addition, the process often confers an aura of generosity and public-spiritedness on the donors, acting as a salve against class resentment. Because of all these advantages, private philanthropic foundations proliferated among the ultra-wealthy during the last century. Today they are commonplace and rarely controversial, but Americans across the political spectrum once regarded the whole idea of private foundations with enormous suspicion. These aggregations of private wealth intruding into the public arena were seen as a form of unelected and unaccountable plutocratic power. The practice began in the Gilded Age with John D. Rockefeller, whose philanthropic advisor, Reverend Frederick Gates, warned him with alarm, Your fortune is rolling up like an avalanche. You must keep up with it. You must distribute it faster than it grows. In response, in 1909, Rockefeller sought legal permission from Congress to obtain a federal charter to set up a general-purpose private foundation whose broad mission was to prevent and relieve suffering and promote knowledge and progress. Critics, including the former President Theodore Roosevelt, assailed the idea, declaring, "No amount of charity in spending such fortunes can compensate in any way for the misconduct in acquiring them." At the time, a parade of notable Americans testified in Congress against the creation of private foundations, including the Reverend John Haynes Holmes, who denounced them as repugnant to the whole idea of a democratic society. Frank Walsh, chairman of the U.S. Commission on Industrial Relations, in 1915 suggested that huge philanthropic trusts, known as foundations, appear to be a menace to the welfare of society. Rob Reich, a professor of political science at Stanford University and co-director of the Stanford Center for Philanthropy and Civil Society, explains that private foundations, which represent virtually by definition plutocratic voices, were troubling because they were considered deeply and fundamentally anti-democratic, an entity that would undermine political equality, affect public policies, and could exist in perpetuity. Unable to gain congressional approval, Rockefeller got the New York State Legislature to approve his plan. Legally, however, the Rockefeller Foundation, the granddaddy of all private foundations, was at first limited to promoting only education, science, and religion. Over time, however, the number of private foundations grew, along with the kaleidoscope of issues into which they delved. By 1930, there were approximately 200 private foundations, according to Reich. By 1950, the number had grown to 2,000, and by 1985, there were 30,000. In 2013, there were over 100,000 private foundations in the United States, with assets of over $800 billion. These peculiarly American organizations, run with little transparency or accountability to either voters or consumers, yet publicly subsidized by tax breaks, have grown into 800 billion pound Goliaths in the public policy realm. Richard Posner, the iconoclastic libertarian legal scholar, has called perpetual charitable foundations a completely irresponsible institution, answerable to nobody, and suggested that the puzzle in economics is why these foundations are not total scandals. When the robber barons first began donating to charities, their gifts were not tax-deductible. With the implementation of the federal income tax in 1913, however, the wealthy soon convinced Congress that unless they were granted a special tax break, philanthropists might no longer donate their fortunes for public purposes. So in 1917, donors were granted unlimited charitable deductions. The rationale was that despite their wealth, they deserved the public subsidy so long as their gifts profited the public rather than their own private interests. Conservatives who opposed the use of the tax code for all kinds of other social engineering nonetheless fully embraced the loophole in this instance. Scaife had already set up his own small foundation by the time his father died in 1958. A family lawyer had explained to him when he turned 21 and received the first booster shot, as he put it, of his inheritance, that charitable foundations provided good tax shelters. Called the Allegheny Foundation, his early foundation was focused on local community improvement projects. In 1964, he added the Carthage Foundation, named for his political club. It focused on national security issues at first. After his mother died in 1965, he and his sister shared control of the much larger Sarah Scaife Foundation, but their different priorities soon created irreconcilable fights. Before long, the siblings were at such odds they ceased speaking to each other for most of the rest of their lives. Cordelia Scaife's priorities, like their mother's, were art, conservation, education, science, and population control. Sarah Scaife had been a friend of Margaret Sanger's and was a staunch supporter of Planned Parenthood. Scaife, too, was a supporter of Planned Parenthood over the years, but his interests tilted more toward what he terms in his memoir, public affairs. By 1973, he had succeeded in reorienting the Sarah Scaife Foundation's grant-making almost entirely to his own causes. The result, he writes, was very considerable grant-making power, enabling him to advance ideas that I believe are good for America. Spurred by tax avoidance, Scaife became not only one of the country's richest citizens, but also one of its biggest philanthropists. This was the beginning of the legend of Richard Mellon Scaife as the dark spirit behind right-wing causes, he writes archly in his memoir. The looming question, though, was how all this money could best be spent. Scaife, who was an early admirer of William F. Buckley Jr.'s, came into his full inheritance just as intellectuals on the right were incubating the idea that they needed to build their own establishment to counter that of the liberals. A leading voice of this cause was a member of Scaife's League to Save Carthage, Lewis Powell, the future Supreme Court justice who was then an eminent corporate lawyer from Richmond, Virginia. And at just that moment, Powell was in search of deep-pocketed donors to bankroll the project. Powell was the author of a brilliant battle plan detailing how conservative business interests could reclaim American politics. In the spirit of Hannibal, it called for a devastating surprise attack on the bloated and self-satisfied establishment, which regarded itself as nonpartisan, but which the conservatives regarded as liberal. Carrying out this attack would be an alternative opinion elite that would look like the existing one, except that it would be privately funded by avowedly partisan donors intent on implementing a pro-business and, critics would say, self-serving political agenda. Powell's ties to corporate conservatives were manifold. In addition to a thriving corporate law practice, he held seats on the boards of over a dozen of the largest companies in the country, including the cigarette maker Philip Morris. So in the spring of 1971, Powell, who was then 63, had watched with growing agitation as student radicals, anti-war demonstrators, black power militants, and much of the liberal intellectual elite turned against what they saw as the depravity of corporate America. Powell believed American capitalism was facing a crisis. All summer long, he clipped magazine and newspaper articles documenting the political threat. He was particularly preoccupied with Ralph Nader, the young Harvard Law School graduate whom Daniel Patrick Moynihan, then Assistant Secretary of Labor, had hired to investigate auto safety hazards. Nader's 1965 expose on General Motors, Unsafe at Any Speed, accused the auto industry of putting profits ahead of safety, triggering the American consumer movement and undermining Americans' faith in business. Powell was a personal friend of General Motors' corporate counsel and regarded this and other anti-corporate developments with almost apocalyptic alarm. That summer, 2 months before Powell was nominated by Richard Nixon to the Supreme Court, his neighbor, Eugene Sidnor Jr., a close friend and director of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, who shared Powell's political upset, commissioned Powell to write a special memorandum for the Business League. In August, Powell delivered a seething memo that was nothing less than a counter-revolutionary call to arms for corporate America, warning the business community that its very survival was at stake if it didn't get politically organized and fight back. The 5,000-word memo was marked confidential and titled, Attack on American Free Enterprise System. A virtual anti-communist manifesto, it laid out a blueprint for a conservative takeover. As Kim Phillips Fine describes it in her history, Invisible Hands, Powell's memo transformed corporate America into a vanguard. Also heeding the battle cry were the heirs to some of America's greatest corporate fortunes, including Scaife, who were poised to enlist their private foundations as the conservative movement's banks. Foundations had several advantages for both the donors and the recipients of this largesse. Unlike most businesses, few people controlled them, so they could move quickly on controversial projects, and they provided the donors with tax breaks while conferring the aura of high-minded cause. Reflecting on this period, James Pearson, a scholar at the Manhattan Institute who became a crucial figure in several conservative foundations, said, "We didn't have anything when we started in the late 1970s. We had no institutions at all in the mainstream of American political life." He debunked what he called the liberal misconception that corporations directly funded most of the far-right movement, arguing, "What we did was way too controversial for corporations." Instead, he said, in the beginning, there were only a small number of foundations, including the Earhart Foundation, based on an oil fortune, the Smith-Richardson Foundation, derived from the cough and cold medicine dynasty, and most importantly, the various Scaife family foundations. The late 1960s and the early 1970s were in fact a daunting time for corporate America and for those living off great corporate fortunes. The business community was reeling from the birth of the environmental and consumer movements, which spawned a host of tough new government regulations. Following the 1962 publication of Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, exposing the devastating environmental fallout from irresponsible chemical practices, Congress passed the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Toxic Substances Control Act, and other laws creating the modern regulatory state. In 1970, with strong bipartisan support, Richard Nixon signed legislation creating both the Environmental Protection Agency and the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, giving the government new powers with which to police business. The standards decreed by the Clean Air Act were notably tough. In developing regulations, the EPA was directed to weigh only one concern: public health. Costs to industry were explicitly deemed irrelevant. Meanwhile, as opposition grew to the Vietnam War, protesters turned angrily against companies they accused of fueling the conflict, such as Dow Chemical, the producer of napalm, which became the target of more than 200 demonstrations in the 1970s. New left leaders like Stroughton Lind urged the anti-war movement not to waste time on Washington, but instead, as he wrote in 1969, to lay siege to corporations. Polls showed that Americans' respect for business was plummeting. As scientists linked smoking to cancer, the tobacco industry was under particularly pointed attack, which might have heightened Powell's alarmism. As a director at Philip Morris from 1964 until he joined the Supreme Court, Powell was an unabashed defender of tobacco, signing off on a series of annual reports lashing out at critics. The company's 1967 annual report, for instance, declared, "We deplore the lack of objectivity in so important a controversy. Unfortunately, the positive benefits of smoking, which are so widely acknowledged, are largely ignored by many reports linking cigarettes and health, and little attention is paid to the scientific reports which are favorable to smoking." Powell took umbrage at the refusal by the Federal Communications Commission to grant the tobacco companies equal time to respond to their critics on television, and argued that the company's First Amendment rights were being infringed. Powell's legal argument failed in the courts, increasing his sense of corporate embattlement. Jeffrey Clements, in Corporations Are Not People, suggests Powell's defense of the tobacco companies was a harbinger of the corporate rights movement and a big part of what led him to push in his memo for conservatives to empower more pro-business courts. Exacerbating corporate America's woes, the economy was buckling from stagflation, the unusual combination of high inflation and high unemployment. There were oil shocks and gas lines as well. And after generations of redistributive progressive income and inheritance taxes, the economic elite was losing its lead. Income in America during the mid-1970s was as equally distributed as at any time in the country's history. No thoughtful person can question that the American economic system is under broad attack, Powell declared in his memo. What distinguished his Jeremiad from many other conservative screeds was his argument that the greatest threat was posed not by a few extremists of the left, but rather by perfectly respectable elements of society. The real enemies, he suggested, were the college campus, the pulpit, the media, the intellectual and literary journals, the arts and sciences, and politicians. Powell called on corporate America to fight back. He urged America's capitalists to wage guerrilla warfare against those seeking to insidiously undermine them. Conservatives must capture public opinion, he argued, by exerting influence over the institutions that shape it, which he identified as academia, the media, the churches, and the courts. He argued that conservatives should control the political debate at its source by demanding balance in textbooks, television shows, and news coverage. Donors, he argued, should demand a say in university hiring and curriculum and press vigorously in all political arenas. The key to victory, he predicted, was careful long-range planning and implementation, backed by a scale of financing available only through joint effort. Powell was not alone. A number of activists on the right issued similar calls to arms, including Irving Kristol, the godfather of neoconservatism. A former Trotskyite, Kristol had become a columnist on the conservative editorial page of the Wall Street Journal, where he counseled business leaders to be more wily about public relations, arguing that they needed to downplay their single-minded pursuit of self-interest and instead tout moral values like family and faith. The Nixon White House aide Patrick Buchanan similarly argued in 1973 that in order to become a permanent political majority, conservatives needed to persuade corporate America and pro-Republican foundations to fund a think tank that would act as a tax-exempt refuge, a talent bank, and a communications center. But it was Powell's memo that electrified the right, prompting a new breed of wealthy ultra-conservatives to weaponize their philanthropic giving in order to fight a multi-front war of influence over American political thought. During this period, Scaife, like many conservatives, was growing disillusioned with more conventional political spending. Goldwater's defeat was a huge personal disappointment. Afterward, Scaife got involved in one more campaign in a big way, donating almost $1 million in $3,000 checks to 330 different front groups associated with Nixon's 1972 re-election campaign. The small increments of cash were designed to evade federal contribution limits. But when Nixon was implicated in the Watergate scandal, Scaife turned against him and against the idea of funding candidates. Scaife, who by then had bought a local newspaper, the Tribune Review, in Greensburg, outside Pittsburgh, published a scolding editorial demanding Nixon's impeachment in 1974. Soon after, he refused to even take the president's phone calls. He was never a big candidate person since, says Christopher Ruddy. Frustrated by the electoral process, Scaife, like Charles and David Koch, sought to finance political victory through more indirect means. Though he continued to donate money to political campaigns and action committees, he began to invest far more in conservative institutions and ideas. His private foundations emerged as a leading source of funds for political and policy entrepreneurship. Think tanks, in particular, became what Pearson called the artillery in the conservative movement's war of ideas. In his memoir, Scaife estimates that he helped bankroll at least 133 of the conservative movement's 300 most important institutions. In 1975, the Scaife Family Charitable Trust donated $195,000 to a new conservative think tank in Washington, the Heritage Foundation. For the next 10 years, Scaife became its largest backer, donating $10 million more. By 1998, these donations had reached a total of some $23 million, which meant that Scaife accounted for a vastly disproportionate share of the think tank's overall funding. Previously, SCAIF had been the largest donor to the American Enterprise Institute, AEI, the older rival conservative think tank in Washington, but Heritage had a new model that won him over. In contrast to the research centers of the past, it was purposefully political, priding itself on creating, selling, and injecting deeply conservative ideas into the American mainstream. In fact, the Heritage Foundation was born out of two congressional aides' frustration with the more conventional think tank model. One of them, Edwin Fulner Jr., was a Wharton School graduate and Hayek acolyte with a flair for fundraising. The other, Paul Weyrich, was a brilliant and fiercely conservative working-class Catholic press aide from Wisconsin, who described himself openly as a radical who was working to overturn the present power structure. The duo had become exasperated by AEI's refusal to weigh in on legislative fights until after they were settled, a cautious approach reflecting the older think tank's fear of losing its nonprofit status. Instead, they wanted to create a new sort of action-oriented think tank that would actively lobby members of Congress before decisions were made, take sides in fights, and in every way not just think, but do. Lewis Powell's memo awoke the financial angels their project needed. The first of these was Joseph Coors, a scion of the arch-conservative Colorado-based Coors Brewery family. After reading Powell's memo, he was so stirred up, he sent a letter to his senator, the Colorado Republican Gordon Allott, offering to invest in conservative causes. Weyrich, who worked for Allott, saw Coors's letter and pounced. He urged the magnate, who seemed to be offering unlimited funds with no strings attached, to come to Washington immediately. "I do believe I've never met a man as politically naive as Joe Coors," he reportedly said with a chuckle afterward. But Coors was enthralled. Weyrich had talked of being engaged in a war to preserve the freedom this country was built on. "Think of what we need as combat intelligence," he told Coors. Coors immediately enlisted. Like the Kochs and SCAIF, he and his brothers had inherited a lucrative private family business along with their parents' reactionary views. A supporter of the John Birch Society, Joe Coors regarded organized labor, the civil rights movement, federal social programs, and the counterculture of the 1960s as existential threats to the way of life that had enabled him and his forebears to succeed. The Coors Brewing Company, founded in 1873 by Adolf Coors, a Prussian immigrant, was famously hostile to unions and had repeated run-ins with the Colorado Civil Rights Commission, which accused the company of discriminating against minority employees. Convinced that radical leftists had overrun the country, Joe Coors, the youngest grandson of the founder, became the center of controversy when, as a regent at the University of Colorado, he had tried to bar left-wing speakers, faculty, and students on campus. His attempt to require faculty to take a pro-American loyalty oath was defeated by the other regents. Enraged that his own son had become a hippie at the school, he railed during a commencement address against pleasure-minded parasites living off the state dole. By the time he connected with Weyrich, he already believed that the right needed new and more militant national institutions of the kind Weyrich described. Before long, Coors became the first donor to the fledgling conservative think tank that Weyrich and Fulner were launching, the forerunner of the Heritage Foundation, then called the Analysis and Research Association. On top of his initial contribution of $250,000, Coors promised $300,000 more for a headquarters building. Soon he was reveling in his new status as a national figure and jetting back and forth from Golden, Colorado to Washington. Backed by the first of many multimillionaire political ideologues, the Heritage Foundation opened for business in 1973. SCAIF's money soon followed on an even bigger scale. A popular saying at the time was, "Coors gives six-packs, SCAIF gives cases." Independent research institutes had existed since at least the turn of the century in the United States, but as John Judis writes in The Paradox of American Democracy, the earlier think tanks strove to promote the general public interest, not narrow private or partisan ones. In the tradition of the progressive movement, they professed to be driven by social science, not ideology. Among the best known was the Brookings Institution, founded in 1916 by the St. Louis businessman Robert Brookings, who defined its mission as free from any political or pecuniary interest. To assure an ethic of disinterestedness, Brookings, who was himself a Republican, mandated that scholars of many viewpoints populate its board. The same ideals animated the Rockefeller, Ford, and Russell Sage foundations, as well as most of academia and the elite news organizations of the era, like the New York Times, which strove to deliver the facts free from partisan bias. Because the self-perception of these institutions was that they were engaged in a modern, even scientific pursuit of the truth, they did not regard themselves as liberal, although frequently the answers they brought to social problems involved government solutions. In the 1970s, with funding from a handful of hugely wealthy donors like SCAIF, as well as some major corporate support, a whole new form of think tank emerged that was more engaged in selling predetermined ideology to politicians and the public than undertaking scholarly research. Eric Warner, the former president of the Russell Sage Foundation, summed it up saying, "The AEIs and the heritages of the world represent the inversion of the progressive faith that social science should shape social policy." According to one account, it was Hayek who spawned the idea of the think tank as disguised political weapon. As Adam Curtis, a documentary filmmaker with the BBC, tells the story, around 1950, after reading the Reader's Digest version of Hayek's Road to Serfdom, an eccentric British libertarian named Anthony Fisher, an Eton and Cambridge graduate who believed socialism and communism were overtaking the democratic West, sought Hayek's advice about what could be done. Should he run for office? Hayek, who was then teaching at the London School of Economics, told him that for people of their beliefs, getting into politics was futile. Politicians were prisoners of conventional wisdom, in Hayek's view. They would have to change how politicians thought if they wanted to implement what were then considered outlandish free market ideas. To do that would require an ambitious and somewhat disingenuous public relations campaign. The best way to do this, Hayek told Fisher, who took notes, was to start a scholarly institute that would wage a battle of ideas. If Fisher succeeded, Hayek told him, he would change the course of history. To succeed, however, required some deception about the think tank's true aims. Fisher's partner in the venture, Oliver Smedley, wrote to Fisher saying that they needed to be cagey and disguise their organization as neutral and nonpartisan. Choosing a suitably anodyne name, they founded the grandfather of libertarian think tanks in London, calling it the Institute of Economic Affairs. Smedley wrote that it was imperative that we should give no indication in our literature that we are working to educate the public along certain lines which might be interpreted as having a political bias. In other words, if we said openly that we were reteaching the economics of the free market, it might enable our enemies to question the charitableness of our motives. Fisher would go on to found another 150 or so free market think tanks around the world, including the Manhattan Institute in New York, to which both SCAIF and other conservative philanthropists would become major contributors. The Sarah SCAIF Foundation, in fact, for many years was the Manhattan Institute's single largest contributor. The donations paid off from SCAIF's viewpoint when they helped launch the careers of the conservative social critic Murray and the supply-side economics guru George Gilder, whose arguments against welfare programs and taxes had huge impacts on ordinary Americans. Fisher's early collaborator in founding the Manhattan Institute was William Casey, the Wall Street financier and future director of the CIA. The early think tank was not a spy operation, but it was funded by wealthy men who had no objections to using pretexts and disinformation in the service of what they regarded as a noble cause. In fact, Scaife, during this period, was simultaneously funding a CIA front group. In his memoir, he acknowledges that in the early 1970s, he owned a London-based news organization called Forum World Features that was, in reality, a CIA-run propaganda operation. He had taken it over from Jock Whitney, the publisher of the New York Herald Tribune, who was a friend of his father's in the OSS. An element of subterfuge was also discernible in Weyrich's early planning. His papers include correspondence that make his political organizations sound like clandestine corporate front groups. One associate writes, "As you well know, business people have been notoriously apathetic in the political field. This is primarily, I feel, due to the businessman's fear of his involvement with respect to his business and possible repercussions from the federal government. The organization we propose would screen him and provide him with a vehicle which would, in effect, do his political work for him at a price." Earlier attempts by American tycoons to hide behind nonprofit front groups had proven both legally and politically toxic. In the 1930s, Democrats gleefully unmasked the DuPont family's funding for the American Liberty League, an ostensibly independent organization that opposed FDR's New Deal, ridiculing it as the American Cellophane League because it's a DuPont product and you can see right through it. In 1950, Congress investigated the group that became AEI, denouncing it as a big business pressure organization that should register as a lobbying shop and get barred from offering its donors tax deductions. In 1965, top AEI personnel took leaves of absence to form the Brain Trust for Goldwater's 1964 presidential campaign. The Internal Revenue Service nonetheless threatened the think tank's tax-exempt status. It was this searing experience that prompted AEI and other conservative groups of this period to avoid the appearance of being too partisan or of acting as corporate shills. But in the 1970s, such concerns became outmoded. Powell and others in the newly aggressive corporate vanguard inverted from a negative into a positive the accusation that conservative organizations were slanted by successfully redefining existing establishment organizations like Brookings and the New York Times as equally biased, but on the liberal side. They argued that a market of ideas was necessary that would give equal balance to all views. In effect, they reduced the older organizations that prided themselves on their above-the-fray public service-oriented neutrality to mere combatants in a polarized war. Disoriented, Brookings and the Times rushed to add conservatives to their ranks in hopes of demonstrating their nonpartisanship. Brookings hurriedly made a Republican its president, while the Times, in 1973, added Nixon's former speechwriter Bill Sapphire to its op-ed page as a columnist. In 1976, after the Scaife-funded Institute for Contemporary Studies issued a report accusing the media of liberal bias, the Times forced out the editorial page editor John Oakes for having an anti-business tone. The Ford Foundation, meanwhile, which had funded much of the early bipartisan environmental movement, as well as the public interest law movement, donated the first installment of $300,000 in grants to AEI in 1972 in an attempt to fight criticism that it was liberal. "That was quite the heist you pulled on the Ford Foundation. Congratulations," a friend exclaimed in a note to a top AEI official. The upshot was that by the end of the 1970s, conservative nonprofits had achieved power that was almost unthinkable when the League to Save Carthage first formed. Enormously wealthy right-wing donors had transformed themselves from the ridiculed, self-serving economic royalists of FDR's day into the respected other side of a two-sided debate. The new hyper-partisan think tanks had impact far beyond Washington. They introduced doubt into areas of settled academic and scientific scholarship, undermined genuinely unbiased experts, and gave politicians a menu of conflicting statistics and arguments from which to choose. The benefit was a far more pluralistic intellectual climate, beyond liberal orthodoxy. The hazard, however, was that partisan shills would create balance based on fraudulent research and deceive the public about pressing issues in which their sponsors had financial interests. Some insiders, like Steve Clemens, a political analyst who worked for the Nixon Center among other think tanks, described the new think tanks as a Faustian bargain. He worried that the money corrupted the research. Funders increasingly expect policy achievements that contribute to their bottom line, he admitted in a confessional essay. We've become money launderers for monies that have real, specific policy agendas behind them. No one is willing to say anything about it. It's one of the big taboo subjects. In an effort to prove their intellectual integrity, all of the new think tanks could cite occasional instances where they parted positions with some of their donors, but far more typical was the example of John M. Olin, a chemical and munitions company magnate whose foundation was a top sponsor of the American Enterprise Institute. Letters from Olin show that he grew increasingly agitated over what he regarded as the think tank's lassitude after he had earmarked a donation demanding that AEI militate against raising the estate tax during the Nixon years. In a note to the think tank's president, Olin railed about the tax as socialism out and out, and complained that if the think tank didn't speak out soon, my estate would be practically liquidated upon my death. David Brock, a conservative apostate who became a liberal activist, described the Heritage Foundation, where he was a young fellow, as almost completely under the thumb of its wealthy sponsors. In his tell-all book, Blinded by the Right, he writes, I saw how right-wing ideology was manufactured and controlled by a small group of powerful foundations, like Smith Richardson, Adolf Kors, Lind and Harry Bradley, and John M. Olin. SCAIF, in his estimation, was by far the most important. Indeed, Brock describes him as the most important single figure in building the modern conservative movement and spreading its ideas into the political realm. How intellectually engaged SCAIF personally was, rather than delegating authority to key advisors, such as his longtime aides Richard Larry and Larry's fellow ex-Marine R. Daniel McMichael, remains something of a mystery. The recipients of SCAIF's largesse, such as David Abshire, head of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and Edwin Meese III, Reagan's former attorney general and a fellow at the Heritage Foundation, invariably praised his acumen. It was Meese who described SCAIF as the unseen hand who brought balance and sound principles back to the public arena and quietly helped to lay the brick and mortar for an entire movement. Yet one former aide to SCAIF, James Schumann, told the Washington Post that had SCAIF not inherited a huge fortune, I don't think he had the intellectual capacity to do very much. In his memoir, SCAIF recounts his life story with some wit and charm, suggesting he could be quick and entertaining, if lacking in self-awareness. Yet one of the few public speeches he gave at a Heritage Foundation rally celebrating Republicans' takeover of the House and Senate in 1994 was less than reassuring about his clarity of mind. SCAIF meandered somewhat incoherently as he declared, "With political victory, the ideological conflicts that have swirled about this nation for half a century now show clear signs of breaking into naked ideological warfare in which the very foundations of our republic are threatened, and that we had better take heed." SCAIF's rambling remarks were made in the same year that he returned to drinking after a life in and out of rehab programs. In 1987, his second wife, Margaret Ritchie Battle, took him with her to the Betty Ford Center. He stayed sober, associates said, for several years. His life, however, remained flamboyantly turbulent. After he met Ritchie, who was married, as was he, in 1979, the couple carried on a soap opera-worthy affair. Scaife claimed he consummated it after Ritchie, a glamorous and memorably feisty Southerner, appeared in his office in an irresistible white Angora sweater. "We did what comes naturally," he told Vanity Fair. She retorted, "Never owned an Angora sweater. I'm allergic to things like that." While they were courting, Ritchie reportedly kicked Scaife in the testicles so hard he had to be taken to a hospital emergency room. Meanwhile, he and his first wife wrangled for almost 10 years over the divorce settlement as he fought to keep her from taking a share of some Gulf oil stock he'd belatedly come into. At one point, in order to evade a subpoena, Ritchie was carried out of Scaife's house rolled in a carpet, like Cleopatra, by his servants. His family life was in tatters. According to Scaife's son, David, Ritchie and Scaife visited him during this period at prep school, Deerfield again, bringing alcohol and marijuana, which Scaife smoked with his son. In 1991, he married Ritchie, who continued to live in her own house around the corner. Their wedding reception scandalized Pittsburgh's upper crust with its blazing double entendre lawn sign spelling out, "Ritchie loves Dick." That scandal paled, however, in comparison with the couple's spectacular breakup. After hiring a private detective who trailed Scaife to a roadside motel where rooms rented by the hour, and after documenting trysts between Scaife and a tall blonde woman named Tammy Vasco, who had an arrest record for prostitution, Ritchie herself was arrested for defiant trespass at her husband's house, for peeping into his windows and crawling in after spying servants setting a romantic candlelit dinner table for two. The charges were dismissed, but the scorned wife soon came to blows with Scaife's housekeeper over custody of the couple's yellow Labrador retriever, Beauregard. After Ritchie succeeded in absconding with the dog, Scaife posted a sign in his front yard reading, "Wife and dog missing. Reward for dog." These skirmishes were a minor prelude to the epic fight over their divorce settlement. Over the advice of his lawyer, Scaife had declined to insist upon a prenuptial agreement with Ritchie, a mistake he regretted bitterly in his memoir. Scaife maintained he hadn't meant to humiliate his former wife, explaining that he just believed in having an open marriage. It was an issue, he joked, that Bill Clinton and I have in common. Tammy Vasco, meanwhile, stayed in Scaife's life through his final days, accompanying him on trips to his houses in Nantucket and Pebble Beach, California, to the chagrin of his household staff and the disdain of Pittsburgh society. A friend of Scaife said that despite her arrest record for prostitution, he kept a photograph of Vasco by his bedside as he lay dying of cancer. All of which calls into question how in 1990 the Scaife Foundation could justify pressing the Heritage Foundation, of which it was the largest funder, to focus more on conservative social and moral issues, and in particular, family values. Heritage's president, Ed Fulner, quickly complied with his donor's request, hiring William J. Bennett. Soon after, Bennett, an outspoken social conservative who had been the Secretary of Education under Ronald Reagan and the Director of National Drug Control Policy under George H.W. Bush, was appointed Heritage's new Distinguished Fellow in Cultural Policy Studies. Lee Edwards, who wrote Heritage's official history, confirms that the Scaife Foundation had particularly in mind the disintegration of the family, an issue which became a major Heritage concern. Bennett also served as a Scaife Foundation director. Equally hard to fathom is how Scaife rationalized his foundation's funding of an obsessive investigation of President Clinton's marital infidelities during the 1990s that came to be known as the Arkansas Project. Hiring private detectives to dig up dirt from anti-Clinton sources, the project funneled smutty half-truths to the American Spectator magazine, which was also funded by Scaife's family foundations. Scaife's foundations also poured money into lawsuits against Clinton, all of which helped whip up the political frenzy that led to the Clinton impeachment hearings. Scaife, meanwhile, succumbed to a far-fetched conspiracy theory positing that the death of the Clinton White House aide Vincent Foster, which police had ruled a suicide, was actually a murder, and, as he put it at one point, the Rosetta Stone to the Clinton administration. Scaife even insisted in an interview that Clinton can order people done away with at will. God, there must be 60 people associated with Clinton who have died mysteriously. Scaife's extraordinary self-financed and largely tax-deductible vendetta against Clinton demonstrated the impact that a single wealthy extremist could have on national affairs and served as something of a dress rehearsal for the Kochs' later war against Obama. Presidents might surround themselves with Secret Service agents and phalanxes of lawyers and operatives, but Scaife proved how hard it was to defend against unlimited, untraceable spending by an opponent hiding behind nonprofit front groups. Eventually, however, the Arkansas Project got so out of hand that Scaife found himself ensnared in a serious legal mess, subpoenaed to testify before a grand jury about possible charges of tampering with a federal witness. One of the two pilots he kept on his staff flew him down to Arkansas in his private DC-9 to testify. No charges were brought. Enraged, however, Scaife cut off the American Spectator from his foundation's funding and turned against his longtime aide, Richard Larry, who had led the anti-Clinton charge. Soon after, Larry resigned. Then, in a stunning turnaround in 2008, Scaife met with Hillary Clinton, who had fingered him as the ringleader of what she called a vast right-wing conspiracy to torment the Clintons. Conservative political pundit Byron York declared, "Hell has officially frozen over." After a pleasant editorial board chat, Scaife came out and wrote an opinion piece in his own paper declaring that his view of her as a Democratic presidential contender had changed and was now very favorable indeed. The rapprochement testified both to Hillary Clinton's political skills and to Scaife's almost childlike impressionability. Repeatedly in his memoir, he changes his political views after meeting antagonists in person, whether the liberal Kennedy family member Sergeant Shriver or the Democratic Congressman Jack Murtha. Like many billionaires, he lived in a bubble, concluded his friend Ruddy, whose relations with the Clintons also thawed. Contrary information rarely penetrated it. Instead, Scaife's family fortune enabled him to build a political bulwark reinforcing his ideology and imposing it on the rest of the country. In Wichita, meanwhile, where he was rapidly expanding his family's company and searching for more effective means than electoral politics with which he could spread libertarianism, Charles Koch, too, was galvanized by Lewis Powell. In 1974, Charles gave a speech to a group of businessmen gathered at a hotel in Dallas, quoting Powell. As the Powell Memorandum points out, Koch warned the group, business and the enterprise system are in trouble, and the hour is late. Koch urged his fellow business leaders to undertake radical new efforts to overcome the prevalent anti-capitalist mentality. He declared that the development of a well-financed cadre of sound components of the free enterprise philosophy is the most critical need facing us today. Opponents of socialistic regulations, he said, should leverage their power by investing in pro-capitalist research and educational programs. That way, he argued, their efforts would have a multiplier effect. Charles's anger at the government by this point was more than merely philosophical. Koch Industries had just become the target of federal regulators. 1 month earlier, the government had charged the company with violating federal oil price controls. By 1975, the government had also cited a subsidiary of Koch Industries for overcharging $10 million for propane gas. More serious government allegations against the company were to come. Not long after echoing Powell's call to arms, Charles, too, set up a think tank, transforming his private foundation into the Cato Institute. The name paid homage to the nom de plume used by the authors of a series of pro-liberty letters during the American colonial period. Its startup funding, according to one account, dwarfed even Scaife's early contributions to the Heritage Foundation, with Charles giving an estimated $10 to $20 million of tax-deductible donations to the nation's first libertarian think tank during its first 3 years. According to Ed Crane, a young, rakish California financier who shared Koch's enthusiasm for libertarianism but lacked his checkbook, the idea for the think tank was his. After the Libertarian Party candidate was predictably crushed in his 1976 presidential quest, Crane, who had been instrumental in the campaign, was ready to go back to the private sector. Instead, Charles, whom he'd met during the campaign, took him aside and asked what it would take to keep him in the libertarian movement. "I said my bank account is empty," Crane later recalled. He said, "How much do you need? A libertarian think tank along the model of Brookings or AEI might be nice," Crane answered, to which, he said, Charles instantly replied, "I'll give it to you." Crane became Cato's president, but early employees at Cato described Charles as single-handedly exerting absolute iron control. David Gordon, a libertarian activist who worked at Cato in the early days, told Washingtonian magazine, "Ed Crane would always call Wichita and run everything by Charles. It was quite clear that Koch was in charge." Another early Cato employee, Ronald Hamowy, added, "Whatever Charles said went." Despite Crane's antipathy toward government, by 1977 Cato was based in Washington, D.C. It soon hired a slew of scholars whom the mainstream media respectfully quoted as nonpartisan experts. Fundamentally, though, Cato was devoted to espousing Charles Koch's vision that government's only legitimate role was to serve as a night watchman, to protect individuals and property from outside threat, including fraud. "That is the maximum," as he told the Wichita Rotary Club in the 1970s. The Kochs consistently depicted Cato and other ideological projects their philanthropy supported as nonpartisan and disinterested. But from the start, the Kochs' ideology and business interests dovetailed so seamlessly it was difficult to distinguish one from the other. Lower taxes, looser regulations, and fewer government programs for the poor and middle class all corresponded to the Kochs' accumulation of wealth and power. It's impossible to know exactly how much money private foundations and trusts, funded by a handful of extraordinarily wealthy families, poured into the right-wing think tanks beginning in the 1970s, or how effective it was. Their grants were soon mixed with those from corporate donors, who cautiously followed the family's bold lead. Unlike other forms of paid political influence, much of this money was never revealed. Gifts to nonprofit groups could be concealed from the public. The new think tanks thus became fast-growing sub rosa corporate arsenals. In fact, after Watergate, the conservative think tanks pitched themselves to businesses as the safest way to influence policy without scandal. By the early 1980s, a list of the Heritage Foundation sponsors found in the private papers of one of its early supporters, Claire Booth Luce, is crammed with Fortune 500 companies. Amoco, Amway, Boeing, Chase Manhattan Bank, Chevron, Dow Chemical, Exxon, General Electric, General Motors, Mesa Petroleum, Mobil Oil, Pfizer, Philip Morris, Procter & Gamble, R.J. Reynolds, Searle, Sears, Roebuck, Smith Kline Beckman, Union Carbide, and Union Pacific were all by then paying the think tank's bills, while the think tank was promoting their agendas. James Pearson, the scholar and key figure in conservative philanthropy, has suggested at a minimum that the think tanks and conservative foundations made conservative ideas respectable. Before the surge in spending, he said, conservatives were seen as cranks on America's political fringe. One measure of the movement's impact was that, starting in 1973 and for successive decades afterward, the public's trust in government continually sank. If there was a single unified message pushed by those financing the conservative movement, it was that government, rather than business, was America's problem. By the early 1980s, the reversal in public opinion was so significant that Americans' distrust of government for the first time surpassed their distrust of business. Another early sign that the investment was yielding real results on the national scale was the Republican wave that swept the 1978 midterm elections. That year, Republicans gained 3 Senate seats, 15 House seats, and 6 governorships. In Georgia, in a development that would have unforeseen future repercussions, Newt Gingrich was elected to Congress. External events such as the energy crisis and stagflation, of course, played into the election results too, but the new conservative think tanks and other right-wing political organizations fanned the discontent and shaped the dominant narrative. Aiding the conservative resurgence was a newly organized and shockingly aggressive independent campaign offensive funded by donors on the right, run by the National Conservative Political Action Committee, or NCPAC, which introduced a whole new level of privately financed attack ads to American campaigns. Growing conservative clout was apparent in Congress, too. The labor movement, which had expected ambitious gains under Jimmy Carter's presidency, instead soon suffered a series of devastating setbacks dealt by the Ascendant Business Caucus, backed by the expanding network of think tanks and outside lobby groups. Weyrich's hand was key here, too. He cemented the movement's influence in Congress by creating the Republican Study Committee, a caucus that united outside activists and conservative elected officials. For years, Heritage Foundation personnel were the only outsiders allowed to regularly caucus with Republican members of Congress because of this hybrid organization. "We are basically a conduit to and from the Heritage Foundation, to and from conservative members of the House," its director, Don Eberle, said in 1983. Weyrich, with Scaife's financial backing, launched several other ingenious political organizations during this period. One was the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, a group aimed at waging conservative fights in every state legislature in the country. From 1973 until 1983, the Scaife and Mellon family trusts donated $500,000 to ALEC, constituting most of its budget. ALEC is well on its way to fulfilling the dream of those who started the organization, a Weyrich aide wrote to Scaife's top advisor in 1976, thanks wholly to your confidence and the tremendous generosity of the Scaife family charitable trusts. When one ALEC administrator complained that Scaife's foundation had too much influence over the organization's agenda, a Scaife employee retorted that they operated on the golden rule. Whoever has the gold rules. Weyrich, meanwhile, dramatically enlarged the conservative groundswell by co-founding with Jerry Falwell the Moral Majority, which brought social and religious conservatives into the pro-corporate fold. Weyrich was particularly adept at capitalizing on white anger over desegregation. The results of these efforts became visible in 1980. At the top of the ticket, Reagan, a movement conservative, overwhelmingly defeated Carter. Conservatives, whose obituaries had been written by the liberal elite just a few years before, were stunningly resurgent. The upset reverberated at every level, including the Senate, where 4 liberal marquee names, George McGovern, Frank Church, John Culver, and Birch Bayh, were all defeated. Scaife, like the Kochs, hadn't initially backed Reagan's candidacy in 1980. In the primary, Scaife preferred John Connolly. It barely mattered, though. By creating their own private idea factory, extreme donors had found a way to dominate American politics outside the parties. Once elected, Reagan embraced the Heritage Foundation's phone book-sized policy playbook, Mandate for Leadership, and distributed a copy of it to every member of Congress. His administration soon delivered an impressive number of items on its wish list. Heritage had laid out 1,270 specific policy proposals. According to Fulner, the Reagan administration adopted 61% of them. Andrew Mellon himself would have been pleased with the succession of hefty tax cuts that Reagan pushed through Congress. He slashed corporate and individual tax rates, particularly helping the wealthy. Between 1981 and 1986, the top income tax rate was cut from 70% to 28%. Meanwhile, taxes on the bottom four-fifths of earners rose. Economic inequality, which had flatlined, began to climb. The fossil fuel industry's fondest wishes were also fulfilled. Following proposals set forth by the Heritage Foundation, as soon as Reagan entered the White House, he abolished the economic controls on oil and gas that Nixon had imposed in order to address the energy crisis. These were among the regulations that Charles Koch had so bitterly opposed. He also cut taxes on oil profits. Koch Industries' profits, predictably, skyrocketed. Forbes noted that Koch, though little known, may well be the most profitable private business in the U.S. The new conservative nonprofits were thriving, too. By 1985, the Heritage Foundation's budget equaled that of Brookings and AEI combined. SCAIF, who by then had donated $10 million to the think tank, was contributing at a rate of $1 million a year. He had gone far to turn Lewis Powell's dream into a reality, but one key part of Powell's agenda remained unfinished. Conservative foundations might have financed a parallel intellectual establishment of their own, but the League to Save Carthage still hadn't conquered America's colleges and universities. The Ivy League was no more hospitable to SCAIF and his ilk than it had been the day he was expelled. SCAIF claimed he was thankful to have been spared the liberal indoctrination. "I was lucky. Higher education did not push me left, and I've never regretted it," he wrote in his memoir. "I'd say the main reason that rich people feel guilty is that the schools teach them they should." That was about to change.